You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. A brief program note, join Lynn Neary on Monday's Talk of the Nation for a look at the growing divide between technophobes and technophiles and how to bridge that gap. We're talking this hour, coming up with Brian Green, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia. He's author of that best-selling book, The Elegant Universe, and he has a new book out that's going to be out in stores next week called The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and Texture of Reality, published by Knopf. It's, you know, whenever we bring on people to talk about the universe, we run out of time asking questions. You have so many questions about how all this stuff works, and I really can feel for you. I feel your pain, as someone once said, because it takes years to understand this. You got to read it over and over and over again, and it's so fantastic that even when you read it, it's hard to believe it. So Brian Green is with us. Brian, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
And tell us about why you wrote this book.
Well, while I was writing The Elegant Universe, I had to exert a great deal of self-control because I wanted that book to tell one story, which was the story of the search for the unified theory. But as I was writing it, it was as though there were these two characters that kept trying to steal the show, and I had to keep them down. And they were space and time. So I really decided while writing The Elegant Universe that I would do a second book in which space and time would be the stars, in which their story, from early thoughts until cutting-edge developments today, would be put out there in a way that people without technical training could get an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, and you walk us through the history of all the theories.
Yeah, this is a subject where seeing the historical progression from Newton's ideas to the ideas of Einstein to the ideas of string theory today really gives you a sense of how our thoughts about space and time have evolved.
Mm-hmm. Do physicists and mathematicians, and I guess when you get into the super atmosphere of that. Those two fields, there's really not much of a difference between the two, is there?
That's right. A lot of times we have to work physicists and mathematicians hand in hand. Sometimes, in fact, we need the mathematicians to develop new mathematics to describe the physics that we're trying to explain.
Now, one of the things he said that really shocked a lot of people, I think, is that, you know, people in his day and even today are still trying to understand the universe. It seems to be getting more complex than simple, but he said it is. He said the most hard thing to understand is that it is comprehensible.
Sure,
you agree with that?
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with the first part of the statement, though. I think that when you look at the explanations we've come up with in the correct context, you recognize although the ideas may be unfamiliar, the explanations really are getting simpler, more economical, more sleek, more powerful.
Yes, but it's getting harder to prove them.
That's true. You know, but that's a sign of progress. We have technology that we use to test our theories, but we've gotten to a point where our theories have so outraced our technological developments that the ideas we have in hand today can't yet be tested, but we hope that will change in the next few years.
Right, let's throw one at you that is one of my favorite topics, and it has to do with something we've talked about before here called entanglement. And to the layperson, it means something happens, could happen on both ends of the universe virtually at the same time, traveling faster than the speed of light, but it could happen.
I'd be a little careful with the phrase traveling faster than the speed of light.
Well, that's what, you know.
It seems
explain entanglement.
Yeah, this is one of the chapters in the book which tries to explain this totally bizarre feature of quantum mechanics, a feature that's so strange that Einstein, who was one of the early people to recognize this feature, called it spooky. He thought it was crazy. He thought this meant that quantum mechanics couldn't be correct, or at least
spooky action at a distance.
Spooky action at a distance. And the idea is this. There are situations in the world, as we know it, according to quantum mechanics, where a particle way over in one location, say California, and a partner particle way over in a different location, say New York, can be set up in such a way that when you measure one, it has an immediate influence or is immediately correlated with a property of the other particle that's 3,000 miles away.
Instantaneously. So if I touch it one way, the other one 3,000 miles away will react also.
It's as if the other particle snaps to attention because, and I put that in quotes, because of what you did to its partner particle far away. And people have struggled to understand how this could be true. Well, normally, if things are separated in space, they are thought to be separate, independent, completely distinct. But there's a way in which they're not.
But and we would say, well, you know, the only it couldn't happen instantaneously. It would have to travel at the speed of light because we've been told that that's the ultimate speed of travel.
Sure, that's why Einstein couldn't stand this idea, because he had firmly come to the opinion, and the scientific world had established, that signals, influences, can't travel from place to place at a speed greater than the speed of light. Now, if something in New York and something in California react at the same time, something instantaneous seems to be going on.
And how does it happen?
Well, quantum mechanics has an answer for how it happens, in the sense that it predicts with certainty what the experimenters will find. But when we try to get an intuition for how it happens, that's where physicists begin to diverge. People have different opinions. I, in particular, think that there's a real well-defined sense in which the two particles are part of one single system. So it's as though when you touch one member of the pair, you are affecting that single system, and in that way influencing its partner particle that naively you'd think is distinct.
Right. And that system was created when the particles were created themselves, when they were bound up at some point?
That's right. So depending on how you set things up in the beginning, when the particles move apart, they have a memory, if you will, of how they initially knew each other when they were together. And then when you touch one, in effect, you're kind of touching both. Now, these words, touch and sort of feel like, sound very vague. And I don't want to give the impression that quantum theory is vague on this. It's precise in what will happen. It's when we try to translate it into ordinary ideas that we can feel in our bones that we find it difficult to do so. But the bottom line is, quantum theory establishes a kind of entanglement, that's exactly the word, that can permeate space, making things that appear to be distinct actually part of one and the same whole.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, and we're talking heavy stuff this hour. So if you think heavy thoughts about physics and cosmology, I'm here with Brian Greene, who's author of The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and Texture of Reality, published by Knopf. Is it out in print yet? Next week?
On Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, okay.
Right.
Run out now, or you order online or something, go to our website at Science Friday. You can order it through there. 1-800-989-8255. Let's start at the top of the phones and go right to John in Las Vegas. Hi, John.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Hi.
Gentlemen, well, listening to you, you just sparked a million different questions in my mind, but I'll stick with my original question here. I wanted to hear a little bit about Hubble's contribution to cosmology. Obviously, we know what it's done for astronomy. But has Hubble made any significant contribution to cosmology, proving, disproving, or changing the way they look at things? And what does he see for technology in the future? What type of technology is he looking at in the future that's going to help to address this?
When you say Hubble, when you say Hubble, you mean the telescope, the space telescope?
Yeah, not Edwin Hubble. Yeah.
Okay, because he did make all those contributions. I was wondering. Okay, what would the space telescope?
Well, the Hubble telescope has given us some of the most precise data about astronomical measurements that we've ever hoped to have gotten. It's fantastically precise and allows us to throw away a lot of competing theories and really hone in on the ones that match this data. It, together with other things, the WMAP satellite, for one, gives us a picture of how the universe looked a mere 300,000 years after the Big Bang. We can look back, in essence, and get a snapshot of what things were like then. And that is critical to pruning away competing versions of the Big Bang and competing versions of various elaborations on the Big Bang called inflationary cosmology. And we finally have been able to start to throw away theories and really put our finger on the ones that can agree with the precise data. People call this the age, the golden age of cosmology. And the reason for that is there was a time many years ago when you could kind of come up with any theory that kind of vaguely agreed with what people could see in the heavens, and it would be a relevant theory.
Right.
But now that's not the case. Your theory has to match this precision data. Cosmology has become a precise science.
I may have said this last time we were talking about this. I was talking to Kip Thorne. I met him by accident at a party, and I said to him, you're in an easy business, you know, because you're in a business where nobody's right, you know. He says, no, I'm in a business where no one is wrong. He said, no, I'm in a business where no one is right.
Right. but that's no longer the case with cosmology, and that's a fantastic new development.
What is the holy grail of cosmology? Is there a particle, a set of particles, either finding it by the Hubble or out in the universe or finding it in an atom smasher that would help advance us to understand this grand unified theory or M theory or string theory or whatever? Is there a particle we're looking to find?
Sure. I mean, in particular, we don't know what constitutes about 90-95% of the universe. A very strange idea if you haven't heard it before, because science seems to have explained so much of the world. But when you learn that the world it has explained constitutes a mere 3-5% of what's out there, right, and the other 95%, we don't even know what it's made of, that really makes you blink your eyes and say, huh, that's kind of astounding. So we'd love to figure out what constitutes the so-called dark matter. That's matter that we know permeates space, doesn't give off light, that's why we call it dark, but we know it's out there by virtue of the gravity that it influences things in its vicinity. We also want to know what constitutes the so-called dark energy. This is a more recent development where we've learned that in addition to the dark matter, there's another dark substance that kind of suffuses space. And we know it's there, again, by distant observations, Hubble and otherwise, of supernovae. And the only way to explain what we see is to posit this energy that exists in space and is pushing space apart. So if we can answer those two key questions.
So are we looking for a new form of nature then? Because if the protons and electrons, whatever that we know, give off the visible stuff that we see, do we have to find ether, something that's out there that we have no idea what it might be, a new kind of nature?
Sure. In a sense, this dark energy is a kind of ether. It doesn't have the properties of the old ether that has long been discredited 100 years ago, but it is something which you believe permeates space, is invisible, doesn't give off light, but nevertheless, the observations indirectly show that it has to be there, or something akin to that has to be out there. Mm-hmm. We don't know what it is.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people with questions. Let's go to Gabe in San Jose. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
My question was actually about string theory. I've read some articles regarding 9-dimensional and 13-dimensional space, and I was wondering if gravitons have been applied to this theory and how they exist.
Glad I have Brian here.
So one of the key features of so-called string theory, which is this attempt to get a unified theory that Einstein was looking for, is that to combine our understanding of gravity and our understanding of quantum mechanics, we seem to be forced to the idea that there are more than three spatial dimensions. In fact, in the current version of string theory, which is called M theory, there are 10 spatial dimensions, not 9, not 13, but 10 spatial dimensions that, if the theory is correct, are really out there. And in terms of gravitons, gravitons are thought to be little particles that transmit gravity in much the same way that photons are little particles of light that enter our eyes and allow us to see things. And indeed, if these ideas are correct, gravitons would permeate, would float through, would move through all of these spatial dimensions. So just like they move through the dimensions we know about, they'd also move through these other ones.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about your book, because I know a lot of thought must have gone into explaining these things. Because as an explainer, I can see the thought almost there. For example, you use The Simpsons.
Sure.
A lot of what you explain, Lisa and what's her name?
Bart.
Bart. They all take trips and go places, almost.
Yeah, if you're not going to
laugh.
Almost
like Mr. Tompkins did in.
Sure.
How long does it take to come up with these analogies? And did you bounce them off of people? Did you try them out on people? Because I know how difficult it is to say, wow, what can I make it so people understand?
Well, pretty much I would write them, and I did have people who would take a look at various chapters and give me some feedback. But my own way that I do research is, of course, I have to use mathematics in order to have precision in the results that I'm seeking. But if I can't translate the mathematics that I'm doing into a mental picture, I kind of don't feel like I really understand what's going on. So when it comes to writing a book like this, I kind of just strip away the mathematics and use the mental imagery that I myself have found useful. Now, I don't always think in terms of Bart and Lisa and The Simpsons. That is an attempt, however feeble, to make this stuff a little bit more digestible, because the ideas are so heavy. But ultimately, we're describing stuff in the real world, and if you can't laugh a little bit while you're learning this stuff, I think it's just too dry.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Brian Greene, author of The Fabric of the Cosmos, this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Do you think like a physicist, like a mathematician? Let me phrase it this way. When I think in a foreign language, you know, I'm translating it in my mind. Do you have to think that way when you do this, or does it come naturally that you see it that way?
No, definitely it's a matter of translation.
Yeah.
Again, when I'm truly thinking about even some of the ideas we've already discussed, dark energy, dark matter, gravity, gravitons, the understanding that I have is ultimately rooted in mathematics. Mm-hmm. And it's constantly going from that mathematical understanding to imagery, to story, to some anecdote that captures what I understand as a mathematical core. I wouldn't be able, personally, I know many people have different approaches to writing science,
right,
but I personally couldn't write popular level science if I didn't constantly anchor it in my mind with the underlying mathematics. Mm-hmm. But that's the bit mm-hmm. that goes in the notes and doesn't go in the main text.
Well, this is your second major work. It's an excellent book. I mean, it reminds me of when I was a teenager trying to grasp these issues. This is a terrific soup to nuts explanation of physics and cosmology. Do you see yourself becoming a popularizer of science more than a scientist? Are you moving in that direction, or how do you want to? You know, I'm thinking of the Carl Sagan phenomenon here. You know, he was a physicist, an astronomer, and then people just thought, well, he's just a popularizer, and he sort of lost it in the eyes of his colleagues. Are you fearful of that, or? Does it worry you, or do you don't care, or do you?
No, I do care. I do care quite a lot. I don't see myself going in that direction at all. Basically, for the reasons that I was just saying, it's mm-hmm. only the doing of the science that I feel informs my ability to write about the science. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't doing the science, I don't think I could write well about these cutting edge ideas. But more than that, in my heart of hearts, I'm truly a physicist. I'm truly one of many thousands around the world who are seeking answers to these deep questions of the ages, and I just like to sort of duck out now and then and might make a progress report, if you will, on the things that we've discovered, but I always go back, and that's really where my heart is.
Well, it is the golden age, as you say. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Richard in San Antonio. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I was pretty interested in the element 115 that was a paper was just written on.
Right.
And I understand that element 115 is capable of producing a gravity A wave, which is possible to, if it's an electromagnetic force, you can amplify it. And if you can amplify it enough, it can provide travel in space by folding space and time.
Mm-hmm. All right, hang on. Let me get a quick answer. We just did a program on this new element, but they didn't talk about any waves. Thanks for calling. Let's talk about. We're going to have to take a break, so let's hold on talking about anything. Stay with us. We'll come back and talk about the concept of gravity as a wave and as a particle and whatever, because that's one half of the of your new formula. You're talking about gravity and space and time and intricately involved in those two. So stay with us. Talking with Brian Greene, author of The Fabric of the Cosmos. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about string theory, the nature of space and time, with my guest Brian Greene, who is professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University, author of the book The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality, 1-800-989-8255. When we were talking before the break, we're talking about gravity waves. It's hard for people to think of gravity and waves and how does that work together?
Well, it's a critical idea, and it's one that really goes back to Einstein's insights in the so-called general theory of relativity, where he gave a new picture for thinking about how gravity works. And the basic idea is that the gravity that we experience is nothing but warps and curves in the fabric of space. It's sort of like if you have a rubber sheet and you put something heavy on it, it causes the sheet to take on a warped shape. And then if you set a marble rolling on the surface, it'll go in some curved trajectory because it's rolling along this curved surface of the rubber sheet. Einstein said, that's how gravity works. But instead of having a rubber sheet, you have space, in fact, space-time. And the curvature is not due to a rock, but it's due to anything that has mass will cause space to warp.
Yeah.
And the warping can ripple through, much like the ripples in a pond when you throw in a pebble. In fact, people are looking now for gravity waves, these ripples in space, through some fantastically interesting and precise experiments mm-hmm. that are seeking to find small distortions in equipment that might show that a wave of gravity from some distant source, a supernova, a black hole, or something of that sort, has rippled by Earth, causing things to stretch and contract as the wave has gone by.
One of Einstein's great gifts and one of the things that he gave to us was this vision of the universe as geometry.
Yes.
Things having, you know, fabric of space, that sort of stuff. You don't hear much about that from physicists now. They're sort of really fixated on particles and sort of stuff like that. Does it still work? Does the geometry, is Einstein still relevant today?
Totally. And in fact, it depends really who you speak to, but today it's really geometry and particles. It's really the marriage between the two pictures that we're working so hard mm-hmm. on to complete. In fact, part of the work that I've done in the last decade has been trying to develop a field called quantum geometry, which has taken the old ideas of geometry that Einstein used to incredible effect to describe gravity and cosmology and mm-hmm. so forth, but update those ideas to include quantum mechanics. And that's, in a sense, what string theory is about. Trying to build this quantum geometry picture of the universe that will go beyond Einstein's pure geometry picture, which didn't take quantum into account.
Can we learn about the particles of the universe from atom smashers and accelerators, or can we learn more about them from looking out in... Let me just amplify what I mean. I mean, I remember when I was studying psychology as an undergraduate in the 60s, I had a professor and he said, you know what you're learning? And you're learning all about rats that run in mazes. I don't believe in that. I don't believe that you can take a rat, breed everything out of them, and learn anything from a rat like that. I think you got to go watch a rat or an animal out in the wild. You know, I'm a Conrad Lorenz guy. I'm not a B.F. Skinner guy. And I think about that a lot because if we try, you know, if you go into the laboratory and you take these individual particles and run it through atom smashers, are we going to miss something by not looking at them out in the wild?
Yes, I think you will. I think you really need both pictures. In fact, during the last 10, 20 years, it certainly has been the atom smasher approach mm-hmm. that has been the one that most people have used. And you basically take particles together, you slam them together at incredibly high speed, you look at the debris, the junk that comes out of the collision, and you right. learn about what they're made of. And that's a powerful approach. But one thing that we've learned, and it's an approach that I'm taking today in my current research, is that the universe supplies us itself with a big atom smasher, if you will. Mm-hmm. The Big Bang is the biggest explosion, in quotes. We have to really say what that means.
Right.
But there was such high energy in the Big Bang that we can use it as a cosmic laboratory. So one thing that I'm doing today is looking for string theory or the imprints of string theory through cosmological observations, through astronomical observations. It's a long shot, but it would be fantastic.
To verify string theory by finding remnants of something?
That's
my
hope.
Can you give us an idea,
sure.
for example, what that might
sure.
be?
Sure. There's this thing called the cosmic microwave background radiation that
right.
was discovered in the mid-60s. It's radiation that exists throughout all of space, and it has a very uniform temperature, 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. But it turns out that the temperature does vary a little bit from one point in the sky to the other. Now, we've understood something about that variation through quantum mechanics. But my hope is that string theory might leave subtle temperature variations that we haven't yet seen in the microwave background radiation. And there are some fantastically precise experiments coming online in the next decade that may be able to measure these temperature variations. And wow, wouldn't that be amazing? To confirm our ideas of the microscopic structure of matter, say string theory or whatever theory it turns out to be, by looking into the sky, by looking into the largest things in the universe. Huh. That connection, looking at the big to verify the small, fills me, I have to say, with incredible, incredible wonder. I hope it works.
Yes. we'll find it. Stay tuned. Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Bob in Tennessee. Hi, Bob.
Hi, a question for Dr. Green or a possible explanation as to the particles that you made reference to, one in New York and one in California. Could it be that they are being collectively affected by a larger magnetic field such that if you move one line of the field that you affect all of them, such as your example a while ago with the pebble in the pond?
I don't think so. We imagine that these experiments can be done. In fact, they have been carried out with particles for which the magnetic field wouldn't have any influence. So it's unlikely that any of these conventional ideas, a magnetic field, an electric field, or something like that, could actually explain what's going on. But I should emphasize, We don't need those explanations. We do have an explanation. Quantum mechanics says, in its most textbooky form, that the universe is permeated by these quantum waves, and those quantum waves are able to correlate the behavior of widely separated particles. The difficulty comes in accepting that idea in our bones, and that's when we have to use more vague language. But quantum theory has no problem. It predicted that this would happen, and in fact, when it was finally carried out, the experiments in the 1980s, the predictions were verified, spot on. So it's not as though this was unanticipated. It's just weird.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to accept weird, Bob.
But hey, that's part of my middle name. That's nothing unusual. I was just this is a twist that I took on it as a layman, if you would, explanation. To the quantum wave, I could identify it more as a magnetic line, a line of energy, which if I bent here, is going to bend somewhere else as well.
But you see, if you did that, we certainly know that disturbances to a magnetic field do travel at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. They don't go quicker than the speed of light. And what we would require for that explanation to work is for those disturbances to travel instantaneously, much faster than the speed of light. That certainly doesn't happen.
Okay.
So that's why this kind of approach just wouldn't quite work.
Get weird, Bob.
Hey, I'm working on it. Thanks.
Thanks. Have a good weekend. 1-800-989-8255. I mean, it is hard to get your mind wrapped around something.
It's hard for me to have my mind wrapped around it. I really have to sit down and think this stuff through. Even though I understand the underlying mathematics, it's so foreign. And I think that's the key thing. Physics has really revealed a universe that's very different from what you'd expect based upon everyday life, everyday perception, everyday experience. It's both wondrous and hard to accept at the same time.
Is it getting harder to get funding to look into these things? Because, you know, science used to be an entitlement, and now it has to compete with, you know, the Department of Agriculture.
Sure, funding is always an issue. We have been funded at reasonable levels, that we've been able to keep our research programs going at a reasonable level. But, you know, we always hope for more because there are some fantastic, interesting ideas that we don't have the time or the money to really study.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Again, let's go to Ben in Memphis. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Hey.
Very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
I've got a question. Hypothetically, would it be impossible, possible, or probable that at some time in the future, our galaxy and solar system will be absorbed by a black hole?
It's certainly possible. It doesn't sound very pleasant. But it's certainly the case that black holes have the ability to, if things get sufficiently close to them, closer than the so-called horizon of the black hole, they have the property that whatever crosses that horizon can't get out. So were we to be unfortunate...
Where's the closest one?
Well, there are black holes, we think, for instance, in the center of our galaxy. That's probably the closest one. And it's a massive black hole. It's got millions of times the mass of the sun. But we're pretty far from it, so I don't think it's something to worry about. But indeed, black holes do have that ability.
That's not keeping you up at night, is it, Nate?
Oh, no. I just have always wondered if it were more probable than possible, but I was always hoping it would be less probable than more possible.
Rest easy. I think it's very improbable.
You'll see someone getting new to the Super Bowl before that happens. So.
Thanks a lot.
See you later.
Can I amplify one point on that?
Sure.
One of the interesting new developments that's perhaps worthy of stating is that in string theory, there's a possibility that microscopic black holes, tiny black holes, may be produced at the next Atom Smasher, the one that should be online in Geneva, Switzerland by about 2008. Yes. If some of the ideas that people are thinking about today, that the extra dimensions that the theory needs are not as small as we once thought, and strings are not as tiny as we once thought, then when you slam particles together in this big Atom Smasher, they may have enough oomph, enough energy, to create a tiny black hole. Now, it wouldn't be dangerous.
All right, you anticipated the...
Sure. I mean, that's a natural reaction.
The email questions.
Sure.
The
natural reaction is that it's dangerous. No. We've learned that tiny black holes, in fact, all black holes, disappear. They can radiate through quantum processes. And the smaller a black hole is, the shorter its lifetime. So these black holes would disappear in a flash. So they would be produced, and then they disappear. No danger whatsoever. But think about that. This Atom Smasher in Switzerland might be a factory for producing microscopic black holes. I mean, wow.
Wow. I have to end with a wow. We're talking with Brian Greene, author of The Fabric of the Cosmos, this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I mean, is there a more exciting business to be in? And The one you're in?
I don't think so.
You get a wow out of that? I mean, how soon would we know if that's possible?
Certainly by the end of the decade.
And what would it show up on the readout that there's a black hole there?
Well, like any particle that disintegrates, a black hole would give off a spray of debris in a particular pattern that researchers would be able to identify that the source of that debris was one of these microscopic black holes.
Now, you said something about we now believe differently than... What do we believe differently now than before?
Well, there's been a big shift in the last 5 to 7 years within string theory, because earlier we thought that strings had to be incredibly tiny, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in size. I mean, that's 100 billion billion times the size of an atomic nucleus. That's how small that is. Mm-hmm. We also thought the extra dimensions that we discussed earlier also had to be roughly the same size, that same tiny size. Recently, we've recognized that that may not be the case. Strings may be bigger. Now, I don't mean really bigger. They would still be
tiny.
Not on
your violin.
That's right. They'd still be tiny, yeah. But they'd only be, say, 100 billion times smaller than an atomic nucleus. Again, it's small, right. But that difference, with respect to the earlier idea, does make a big difference in whether we can see evidence of these ideas in an atom smasher. So this is the new idea, that the size of these things may be bigger, they may be more accessible, and therefore it's possible, unlikely, but possible, that we may see evidence of them in the next generation of atom smashers.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go from here? Back to the office, going to work?
Right. From here, I got to go teach my course.
Do you get students interested in this?
Oh,
is
sure.
Are finding more interest in this, or is it harder to find physics?
Not at all. I think the students are fired up about these ideas. It's a great time in the field. So much is happening. And there's so much new data. That's really the key thing. New data will be coming in through astronomical observations, through these new accelerator experiments. And there's no doubt that there are going to be surprises in that data. And students want to be there when that happens, to be the one that explains what's going on.
Now, we're glad you're there to explain it to us, Brian. Thank you very much for joining us. Brian Green, professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia. His new book in stores is... The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and Texture of Reality. If you want one book that explains soup to nuts, as I said before, how the universe works and where it all came from and all that kind of stuff that you have hard time on Science Friday listening to, this is the book to do it. It's published by Knopf. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director, our audio engineer. Well, we got Matt Galick and Paul Masiello here in New York, and Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Finn. Next week, as I say, we'll be in Seattle at the Convention Center. You're invited if you're attending the AAAS annual meeting, or you just live in and around Seattle. Why don't you just stop by and join us, sit in our audience. You can check out our website at sciencefriday.com for details where we're going to be at the convention center. And while you're also on our website, you can download free teaching materials we make on Science Friday's Kids Connection and also past programs. You can download them on your iPod or your other audible.com recorder. We'll see you next week from Seattle. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.